inanimate design as a problem for atheism. When the Apostle Paul presented the gospel to people unfamiliar with Scripture, as we see, for instance, in Acts 14 to, let's say, sort of average pagans at Lystra, or in Acts 17 to rather educated pagans at Athens, one of his approaches was to appeal to nature as evidence for the existence of God. Similar arguments for the existence of God from design and nature continue to be popular for centuries, perhaps reaching a peak in the work of William Paley in his Natural Theology, written in 1802, and then in the Bridgewater treatises, 12 volumes by 8 different authors, published in the 1830s. However, this sort of line of argumentation has rather generally been abandoned now for over a century under the impact of Darwin's Origin of Species. Many, many people felt that Darwin had explained design by means of natural selection of random variations, and which one of those survived various changes in certain in the environment, and therefore that this whole line of argumentation was undercut. In recent years, however, some serious questions have been raised regarding the sufficiency of evolution to explain the origin of life and its diversity. Two very striking books that I've just read this year on this subject is a work by Michael Denton called Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, published by a rather small publisher in Bethesda, Maryland, Adler & Adler, but being handled by a major publisher. And then a work by Gordon Rattray Taylor, The Great Evolution Mystery, published by Harper & Row. Likewise, a rather interesting work published by 3 evangelical authors. Those two, by the way, Denton and Taylor, as far as I know, are not even theists from anything they said. But a third work published by Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson, The Mystery of Life's Origins, published by Philosophical Library, New York, secular publisher, but the writer of Evangelical Christians, deal with a very difficult problem of getting life out of non-life by any kind of random processes, any kind of non-directed processes. So in recent years, serious questions have been raised regarding the sufficiency of evolution as an explanation for the origin of life and for its diversity. To the extent that evolution itself is unable to explain biological design in nature, then the value of such evidence for the existence of God can once again be seen. In any case, biological evolution can hardly explain design in the non-living part of nature. And it's just here that recent advances in science have uncovered far more evidence for a designer today than was known in Darwin's time, or to some extent that was known even 10 years ago. We want to look at some of that evidence this evening. Life depends upon the more basic substratum, which we study in chemistry and physics. Beneath all of the life on Earth, we have the right chemistry, the right environment, and the right universe. I'd like to look at each of those in turn. Consider, first of all, the right chemistry. All life on Earth depends on the operation of very complex biochemicals containing thousands or even millions of atoms in each molecule. These biochemicals include DNA and RNA, which store and transmit the information on how living cells operate. They also include proteins, which provide most of the structure of living things and cause the necessary chemical reactions to occur at rates sufficiently rapid for plants and animals to be able to respond to changes in their environments. All these molecules possess enormous complexity and very specific structures to carry out particular specialized tasks. Such organization itself presents a serious challenge to anyone who thinks that life arose by random processes rather than by design, but that is not the subject of this particular paper. It is interesting that when I was in grad school, one of the outstanding men in the area of cosmology was Sir Fred Hoyle, who was a rather outspoken atheist at that time. Since then, since the late 60s, he has moved over to a theistic position as a result of his studies of the origin of life. And his recent work, Evolution from Space, A Theory of Cosmic Creationism, reflects some of this sort of change that's taken place in his position. But as I said, this question of the organization in life molecules is not the subject of this paper. On a much simpler level, the properties of carbon, of phosphorus, and water suggest that life didn't just happen. Carbon is the only element in existence which will form chains of almost unlimited length. And yet, it is just these kind of changes, these kind of chains, that are needed for the complex molecules, DNA, RNA, and protein, that occur in living things. Now, as best we can tell, operating on assumptions in the old universe and information we have from cosmology, as best we can tell, all the carbon in our universe apparently was formed inside stars and then scattered over space when the stars exploded. Yet only because of two rather coordinated quirks in nature is it true that carbon is a common element rather than a very rare element. Carbon is formed inside stars by a rare collision of three helium nuclei. Two helium nuclei are not very stable, and so you really need this three-nucleus collision to produce carbon. Were it not for the fact that the temperature at the inside of stars is just right at the energy level of what we call a resonance in carbon, very little of this carbon would be formed. A resonance is an energy level of the helium nuclei at that temperature that it's just right that two of the nuclei will stick together for a long time at that temperature, but not above or below it, long enough to have a chance for a third collision. Otherwise, if you go a fair temperature above or below it, they don't hang together very long, and the chances of forming such triplets are very, very small. If, in fact, this resonance energy were only 4% lower, carbon would be extremely rare. On the other hand, carbon, under such conditions, easily combines with another helium nucleus to form oxygen. We're thinking of thermonuclear reactions such as go on inside stars. But it just happens that the temperature in stars is just a little above the resonance for forming oxygen. And therefore, the result is that you don't get the stuff all going into oxygen. If this resonance were only 4% higher, just as the other one, if it were only 4% lower, if this resonance were only 4% higher, nearly all carbon would convert to oxygen. In either case, carbon would be very rare, and life itself would be rare or non-existent, not only on Earth, but anywhere in the universe. As far as I know, there's nothing published on the subject, but there is something published secondhand on the subject, but Fred Hoyle is supposed to have said to one of his colleagues, "Nothing ever shook my atheism so much as seeing the location of these two resonances that makes carbon a common element instead of a rare one." Well, then his further studies in the origin of life went further in that direction. That comment can be found in an article by Owen Gingrich, a Christian astronomer at Harvard University, in his article, "Let There Be Light, Modern Cosmogony and the Biblical Creation," one of the few, I think, rather sound articles that occurs in this work, "Is God a Creationist?" That has been put together a couple years ago. So much for carbon. Phosphorus is unique among the chemical elements in that it forms certain compounds which can store large amounts of energy. Without these compounds, there would be no higher animal life, since higher animals need such an efficient method of energy storage in order to function properly. Yet only phosphorus of all the elements has this capability. It almost looks like phosphorus was designed for this purpose. The familiar chemical we call water is at least as unusual as carbon and phosphorus. Its molecule, a combination of two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen, is very small and is lighter than molecules of nitrogen and oxygen. Two nitrogens, two oxygens, both weigh quite a bit more than one oxygen and two hydrogens. It should, therefore, be gaseous at temperatures suitable for life. However, water forms itself into what we call polymers, combinations of two or three water molecules loosely stuck together, so that in fact it's a liquid at these temperatures. As a liquid, it's a very important component of the blood of animals, the sap of trees, and the fluid in living cells. Yet when water evaporates, it no longer forms polymers. This allows it to disperse in the atmosphere so that it doesn't lay on the ground and stifle life as an unbreathable gas. This incident that took place recently the place where all these people were strangled to death by this water, this stuff that came up out of the lake. Cameroon? Yeah, Cameroons. Is an example of the kind of problem you would have if water stayed polymeric in its gaseous form and laid near the ground. As far as we can tell, Most of their trouble was from carbon dioxide, just sat on the ground, and they didn't realize what was happening and couldn't get out somewhere to where they could breathe in a reasonable length of time. So when water evaporates, it no longer forms the polymers. This allows it to disperse in the atmosphere, so it doesn't stifle life by lying on the Earth's surface as an unbreathable gas. No other substance has this property. Water is also a universal solvent, carrying the many necessary solid chemicals which circulate in the bloodstream, in plant sap, and in living cells. All other liquids which can dissolve a comparable number of chemicals are highly corrosive and deadly to living things. Water is unusual in its ability to absorb a large amount of heat for a given change of temperature, called heat capacity. As a result, it moderates the climate of the Earth and helps stabilize body temperature of animals. Like few other substances, water expands rather than contracting when freezing. This feature prevents the oceans from freezing all the way to the bottom, which would kill marine life, and it aids in the formation of soil by splitting up rocks. Truly, water is the most amazing substance. Like a thirsty traveler on a hot day, a chemist can say, there's nothing like it. Thus, the universe has just the right chemistry to support life, and this depends on certain physical constants being just the right size, and on some unique chemicals for which there are no substitutes. Is this an accident? Is it merely an artifact of observation? Is this true only because if it weren't, we wouldn't be here to talk about it? We'll return to these questions later, but not until we've considered the evidence of design in our environment and in the basic forces which operate in our universe as a whole. Environmentally, our Earth is unique in the solar system and at least very rare in our galaxy. The temperature of the Earth's surface varies substantially from pole to equator, from summer to winter, and from the Dead Sea to Mount Everest. Yet, it never exceeds the boiling point of water, except in the vicinities of volcanoes and geysers. Temperatures below freezing are much more common, occurring on high mountains, even at the equator, at moderate latitudes in the winter, and year-round at the poles. Yet our oceans never freeze up completely, even in Arctic regions, because of our proximity to the sun, because of internal heat from the Earth, and because of this peculiar property of water that expands on freezing. By contrast, the average temperature of Venus, our nearest neighbor planet in the sunward direction, is about 900 degrees Fahrenheit. Enormously high temperature. On Mars, the next planet further away, temperatures barely rise above freezing even in midsummer at the equator. Earth alone, among the planets of the solar system, has the right temperature range for life. Warm enough for water to be a liquid, cool enough that complex life molecules are not destroyed. A substantial amount of water is also needed in the environment to support life, though a few organisms have special techniques for preserving water so they can live in arid conditions. For the Earth as a whole, measuring from the center out to the surface, the fraction of terrestrial water is really quite small. But this is all concentrated at the surface, so that our globe is two-thirds covered by water at an average depth of 3 miles. The water on Venus and Mars is infinitesimal, by contrast. Earth also has the right atmosphere. Consider merely its oxygen content. If there were much less oxygen in our atmosphere, animals would not have enough to breathe. You say, well, if they had a lot less, then they just move slower or something, which of course would be true. But if you move too much slower, you don't move fast enough to adjust to changes in the daily temperature or the seasonal temperature, etc. You can't move any as much slower you want to. It's got to be within a certain range. That work. So if there were much less oxygen, our animals would not have enough to breathe. If there were much more, plant life would be burnt up. Mars and Venus have virtually no free oxygen, so necessary to most kinds of life. Earth's gravity is also just right. If the Earth were only one quarter as massive as it is, the atmospheric pressure would be too small to support life. If the Earth were twice as massive, the atmosphere would be thick enough to work like a greenhouse in summer, raising the temperature enough to kill us all. Again, you've got these boundaries. You get down too cold, water freezes, you've got no chemicals that can function in a liquid state that are reasonable solvents to transport the stuff that needs to be transported, and you run the temperature up too much, your life chemicals won't stay together. Nobody knows how to design life that will work in very, very different kinds of circumstances. Earth has the right kind of sun. A sun only 20% larger would burn up its fuel in only 4 billion years. Obviously, among Christians, there's some argument over the age of the universe and such, but going here again on the evidence for an old earth and arguing with people who hold an old earth. By this time, if the sun were 20% larger, such a sun would have expanded into its red giant stage. The earth would have burned up as it became enveloped by the sun's atmosphere. On the other hand, if our sun were only 20% smaller, it would not produce enough ultraviolet light for plants to be able to make sugar and oxygen. Photosynthesis requires a certain amount of ultraviolet. If you run down the mass of a star by 20%, you've got very little ultraviolet in its spectrum, and then you're not going to get the production of photosynthesis. You don't get the sugar and oxygen, and both sugar and oxygen are needed for animals to live, and they can produce neither by themselves. The right kind of sun cannot vary much in brightness, or life will not survive. In fact, our sun's luminosity already has varied too much over the past 4 billion years, increasing in brightness by some 25%. But the creation of plant life was timed just right to save the day. As the sun got hotter, plants removed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and replaced it by oxygen at just the right rate to turn down the greenhouse effect and to keep the temperature on Earth in a range safe for life. This trick, performed by the plants, only worked because the Earth was at the right distance from the sun. If it had been 5% closer, the greenhouse effect would have been too strong. Early in Earth's history, the plants would never have gotten started, and Earth would now be a furnace like the Venus, though slightly cooler, 500 degrees instead of 900 or something like that. But if the Earth had only been 1% further from the sun, the cooler temperatures about 2 billion years ago would have produced a runaway ice age, and the Earth would now be like Antarctica everywhere. One of the tricks which many people don't realize is ice ages tend to magnify themselves. When you begin to get more snow falling than will melt in the summer, that means that the average whiteness of the surface goes up substantially. The reflectivity of that area goes up. That area reflects much more of the sunlight back into space and doesn't absorb it, and the temperature goes down further. And so they tend to build on themselves, and it's been calculated by a fellow named Michael Hart that if the Earth were only 1% further from the sun, so we got a 6% narrow band that the Earth could be in to avoid either the runaway greenhouse early or the runaway ice age a little later. Thus, the Earth has just the right environment. Can we reasonably explain this away as an accident and claim there was really no designer behind the universe? Let's save this question for discussion until we've considered the evidence of design in the basic forces of our universe. Not only do we live in a universe having the right chemistry to support life, and on a planet with the right environment for life, it also turns out that the basic forces in our universe are just right. Without the precise balance which exists among these primary forces, life would be impossible anywhere in our universe. So far as we know, there are just four basic forces in the universe. We call gravity, electromagnetism, the strong and the weak nuclear forces. The weakest of these is gravity, which is some 40 powers of 10 weaker than the strongest, the so-called strong interaction. 40 powers of 10 difference between the strong interaction and gravity. Gravity dominates at large distances in our universe because the other three forces either act only over short distances, strong and weak interaction, or they cancel out in the case of the electromagnetic force. The electromagnetic force is the most familiar of these other three forces. It's responsible for electricity, for magnetism, for holding the electrons of an atom to their nucleus, and for holding together matter to form solids. It is much stronger than gravity, and like gravity, can act over long distances. However, the electromagnetic force is produced by charged particles, which may have either a negative or a positive charge. The like charges, two positive, repel one another, two negatives repel one another, and the opposite charges, a positive and a negative, attract one another, therefore tending to produce combinations of positive and negative which cancel each other out, so that you've got no net charge a short distance away from the two particles. This decreases the resulting force. By contrast, gravity has only what we might call positive charges, that is mass, and these positive charges attract one another, the opposite of what positive charges do in electromagnetism or negative charges do. So they add together to increase the total force rather than canceling out. The strong nuclear force holds together the neutrons and protons that make up the nucleus. It's the binding force inside the nucleus. It acts strongly, but only over very short distances, about 10 to the minus 13th centimeters radius of a typical nucleus. The weak nuclear force, as the name implies, is weaker by about 100,000 times than the strong force, though it's still much stronger than gravity by about 34 powers of 10. It also acts over short distances and is involved in a number of less familiar activities, such as the decay of a neutron into a proton, electron, and neutrino. As suggested above, the balances that exist between these forces in our universe are precise, making possible life as we know it. Consider, first of all, the delicate balance between gravity and the expansion speed of our universe. Since the 1920s, it has been apparent that our universe is expanding, apparently from an event known as the Big Bang, which occurred some 15 to 20 billion years ago. Whether our universe is expanding fast enough to continue to do so forever, or whether it will eventually stop expanding and start collapsing, are alternatives still hotly debated among cosmologists. The evidence at present favors a permanent expansion. In any case, it is obvious that the actual density of matter in our universe is within a factor of 10 of the so-called critical density, the point of exact balance between permanent expansion and eventual contraction. But for the density to be even so close to this critical density as a factor of 10, after some 20 billion years of expansion, it must have been very precisely tuned in the earliest moments of the Big Bang. That is, the equations of the behavior of a system like this, equations of general relativity, are divergent. And so the various densities in a pattern will diverge from one another as time goes on. For the density to be even so close to this critical density after some 20 billion years of expansion, it must have been very precisely tuned at the earliest moments of the Big Bang. At, say, 10 to the minus 43rd seconds after the Big Bang, far smaller amount of time than we possibly measure, the so-called Planck time, the density must have been equal to the critical density to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 60th. The practical effects of this fine tuning are two. If the density had been ever so slightly higher, then the universe would have collapsed quickly instead of lasting some 20 billion years, and there would never have been the opportunity for life to form. On the other hand, had the density been ever so slightly smaller, the universe would have expanded much more rapidly than it did, and no galaxies, stars, or planets would have formed. Again, no life. Life is the result of fine-tuning the density of matter energy at the Planck time to 1 part in 10 to the 60th. Life depends on the existence of a number of the heavier chemical elements, especially carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. Only hydrogen, helium, and a few of the very lightest elements would be formed in the Big Bang itself. The rest are formed inside stars. It is the behavior of the strong and the weak nuclear forces that control how stars operate. If the strong force were much weaker than it is, there would be very few stable elements. For instance, if the strong force were only 50% weaker, that sounds like a lot, but remember it's 10 to the 40 from strong down to gravity, so there's a lot of room out there. If the strong force were only 50% weaker, not even iron and carbon would be stable. Without these elements, there could certainly be no life as we know it. But if the strong force were only 5% weaker, the element deuterium would not exist. That's a hydrogen with a neutron. It's a heavy hydrogen, call it. But deuterium is necessary to allow stars to burn, and they certainly would not burn at all like they do now if deuterium did not exist. On the other hand, if the strong force were only a few percent stronger than it is, another thing, the diproton, would exist, two protons together. The only thing we have with two protons together is helium, and that exists two protons and two neutrons. Or you can have a light helium, two protons and one neutron, but two protons by themselves, there's not enough strong force to overcome the repulsion of the two positively charged protons, and so it splits apart. If the strong force were only a few percent stronger, the diproton would be stable. Protons would combine by the strong interaction to form deuterium. Stars would burn catastrophically instead of very slowly, as they do now. The strong interaction thus has to be just the right size to have stable stars and stable elements for life chemistry. But the weak nuclear force is important too. As mentioned above, the heavier elements are formed in the interior of stars as a part of the aging process. The star burns up its hydrogen inside, where it's very hot, and then it begins to collapse when it's used up all that hydrogen. And as it collapses, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter on the inside, and eventually gets hot enough to combine heliums, three of them, into carbon, or four of them into oxygen, such so you get carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and such. And then it collapses some more, and it forms even heavier elements. But they're inside a star, where they're not much use for living things. So stars first burn hydrogen to form helium. The helium is combined to form carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. These, in turn, are burned, that is, a nuclear reaction, in the center of aging stars to form the even heavier elements, such as silicon, iron, lead, and uranium. But were it not for the weak force, all of these elements would remain trapped inside the stars, where they would be of no use for life. However, when a star has used up most of its nuclear fuel, it begins to collapse, becomes very hot inside, and begins producing a large number of small particles we call neutrinos, which interact with other things only by the weak interaction. Very little gravity, maybe no mass. They've got no strong interaction, etc., and they have no charge. It becomes very hot inside and begins producing a large number of neutrinos. As neutrinos escape from the star, because the weak force is just the right strength, they grab hold of the outer layers of the star, causing the star to explode and to scatter its elements all over its own neighborhood. A supernova-type explosion takes place. These elements will later become part of the next generation of stars and form planets which accompany such stars. As a result, the Earth has the heavy elements so necessary for life. If the weak force were much smaller than it is, the neutrinos would escape quietly. They wouldn't interact with this stuff sufficiently to pull it out, and we'd have no heavy elements outside the stars. The star would not explode. No heavy elements would escape. If, on the other hand, the weak force were much stronger than it is, the neutrinos themselves would not be able to escape. They would be slowed up by the material as they tried to get out, and we'd again have no explosion and no heavy elements outside the stars. Thus, if the weak force were much different than what it is, there would be no heavy elements outside of the stars. There's one more crucial balance we need to discuss. Gravity, as I mentioned, is much weaker than electromagnetism by 37 powers of 10. Yet gravity dominates in the realm of astronomical distances. Why is this so? Both gravity and electromagnetism are long-distance forces. Both of them increase inversely as the square of the distance. They both drop off at the same rate. Why should not electromagnetism, being 37 powers of 10 more powerful than gravity, be more important than gravity in controlling the movements of planets, stars, and galaxies? The reason is that electromagnetism is produced by two kinds of charges, negative and positive, and that these occur in equal numbers, so that at large distances, they cancel each other out. But why is this? Why should there be exactly equal numbers of positive and negative charges? Scientists don't know. The main negative charge is the electron, which is a very small particle compared with the main positive charge, the proton. There's a difference in size of about 2,000 in mass, 1836, I think, is the actual number. In modern cosmological theory, as the universe cooled down from the Big Bang, protons would be frozen out of the universe, if you like, much earlier than electrons. What do I mean by frozen out? Well, at very high energies, the various particles are colliding with each other with enough energy that collisions will produce so much energy that they will make pairs of protons and antiprotons. You need an energy equal to mc squared, where M is equal to the mass of a proton plus the mass of an antiproton. And that is 1836 times the mass of an electron. So at energies up about 1836 times that of the electron, when these collisions occur, you will make more of these. And then as they run into each other, they will annihilate more. So as long as you're in high enough energies, the temperature high enough in the Big Bang, density high enough in the Big Bang, you'll be making and annihilating this stuff in such a way as to have a large number of these around. But when the temperature of the Big Bang, as it expands, the universe expands, drops below the threshold in which you can make any more of these, then the protons and antiprotons begin to annihilate. And if there's an exactly the same number, you'll wind up with none. They all collide. If you've got some slight difference between them, you'll wind up with a few of one of them, whether they be antiprotons or protons. It's rather obvious in our universe, we wound up with a number of protons and used up all the antiprotons. The temperature has to drop by a factor of 1836 to get down to the place where exactly the same thing stops for the electrons. Electrons moving around in all the particles moving around at very high temperatures will produce pairs of electrons and anti-electrons, what we call positrons. And some will annihilate one another, and then other collisions will produce more of them, etc., until you get down to the temperature where there's not enough energy to produce them, which, as I say, is 1836 below this, because here you're producing a pair of each, which weigh one compared to this 1836. And then the electrons and positrons, the electrons and anti-electrons, they begin to cancel each other out by collision and turning back into energy. And there's not enough energy to make any more. And lo and behold, they cancel out just the right way that there's the same number of electrons left as there were protons left way back there when the other one stopped, when the other process stopped. In modern cosmological theory, as the universe cooled down from the Big Bang, protons would have frozen out much earlier than electrons. And there's no obvious reason why the two should be equal in number. In fact, it's not even obvious why there should be any positively charged protons, since it's assumed that earlier in the history of the universe there were an enormous number of positive protons and negative antiprotons, and that these annihilated each other when the universe cooled down below the temperature necessary to produce proton-antiproton pairs. But apparently, there were a few more protons and antiprotons, so these were left over when all the antiprotons were used up. Much later, the universe cooled down enough so that they were no longer able to produce electron-antielectron pairs. And again, almost exactly the same number of electrons were left over to balance out the positive charge of the leftover protons. The number of electrons and the number of protons left over must have been the same to much better than 1 part in 10 to the 37th power. Or otherwise, electromagnetism would dominate at astronomical distances instead of gravity. If this had not happened, our universe would be dominated by electromagnetism. What would this mean? Well, we don't know all the ramifications of such a situation. At least, there would be no galaxies, stars, or planets, since these structures are all dominated by gravity. It is doubtful that a stable universe of any sort could exist for the billions of years needed for life on Earth in such circumstances. Recall our discussion previously on the balance between gravity and expansion, where you had to have the right density to 1 part in 10 to the 60th to keep the universe from either expanding too fast or collapsing too fast. The same kind of problem if you had an electromagnetic-dominated universe. Likewise, it's unlikely that the radiation could travel long distances in a universe where electromagnetism dominates, in which case one could not have a pleasantly warm planet getting heat from a hot, distant sun. Back in the early history of the universe, we have this point that we call Big Bang, which is right at the instant the universe begins, apparently. And then much later, The universe from that point down to a period much later is a vast glowing ball that light doesn't travel very far in at all because light is absorbed by other materials inside it. As it cools down, it suddenly at one point clears up so that light can travel long distances. And what is happening there is that's the point that you cross when gravity begins to dominate over electromagnetism. You then cool down to a point where the universe clears up. So to have a universe in which light can travel long distances is a result of this very close balance and the cooling off of the universe. In view of all these carefully tuned balances between the forces in our universe, it becomes obvious that with very slight changes in the strength or balance of these forces, we get a universe which will not support life of any sort such as we can imagine. What do we make of this? Simplest explanation is that we live in a designed universe. Scientists have been discussing this problem for several years now. As Stephen Hawking has pointed out in a book by John Boslow, Stephen Hawking's Universe, the odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous. I think there are clearly religious implications whenever you start to discuss the origins of the universe. There must be religious overtones. But I think most scientists prefer to shy away from the religious side of it. In shying away from the religious explanations, some have suggested that this apparent design is merely an accident of observation. Admittedly, life would be impossible unless all the factors discussed above come out just right. But if life were impossible, then we wouldn't be here ourselves, and there would be no one to observe such a universe. Conversely, there will only be observers in a universe where all these factors work out just right. This explanation, that the order of the universe is just an accident of observation, is called the anthropic principle. If man wasn't here, he wouldn't observe it. If the universe weren't this well-balanced, man wouldn't be here to observe it. Now, this principle, called the anthropic principle, or more precisely, the weak anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is certainly a clever explanation, and it's undeniably true in some sense, yet it still leaves us with the existing universe as a fluke of vanishingly small probability. As an explanation, it is methodologically much inferior to any theory in which the universe such as ours would be a likely result. But if such a being as the God of the Bible exists, then an apparently designed universe such as ours would be a likely result, rather than such a surprise as we have it in an accidental universe. Not all those who espouse the anthropic principle are satisfied with the so-called weak form sketched above. Some have moved into Eastern mysticism, pantheism, or something equally esoteric to propose a strong anthropic principle. In this view, man himself has somehow caused the world to be just right to allow life and humanity to exist in it. Whether this is done by man being a part of a God who is everything, or by some theory which allows causes to produce effects backward in time instead of just forward in time, so that man has somehow caused the universe to be the way it needs to be for him to exist further on down the line. Such suggestions attempt to provide a model in which the special order found in the universe has some adequate cause, since this is seen as a serious defect in the weak anthropic principles. Such views range far beyond the scientific evidence discussed here, and also beyond the scope of our paper. To answer such suggestions, we must consider how the evidence for the existence of the God of the Bible compares with the evidence adduced for the particular worldview espoused, whether it be backward causation or pantheism or whatever. I merely comment that I'm unaware of any evidence for such positions comparable to that for the God of the Bible. To return to the weak anthropic principle, however, some are hopeful that further investigation will reveal that our universe has to be the way it is, that it is merely the logical result of laws that lie behind it. This is doubtless one motivation for physicists who are seeking to explain all four basic forces in our universe as merely varied manifestations of one single force, often called the superforce. We must continue to remind ourselves that the dream of finding such a superforce has not yet materialized, and may never do so. Many research programs of great promise have never panned out. But even if it should turn out that some such superforce lies behind the four basic forces, the problem of design will not be so easily solved. As Paul Davies says in his recent book, Superforce, The Search for a Grand Unified Theory of Nature, Simon Schuster, 1984, should we conclude that the universe is a product of design? The new physics and the new cosmology hold out a tantalizing promise that we might be able to explain how all the physical structures in the universe have come to exist automatically as a result of natural processes. We should then no longer have need for a creator in the traditional sense. Nevertheless, though science may explain the world, we still have to explain science. The laws which enable the universe to come into being simultaneously seem themselves to be the product of exceedingly ingenious design. If physics is the product of design, the universe must have a purpose. And the evidence of modern physics suggests strongly to me that the purpose includes us. So, Davies' remark. It's rather interesting. A fair amount of this material comes from an earlier book by Davies, written in 1982, The Accidental Universe, where he was quite clearly an atheist. And yet, by the time he writes this other work in 1984, he has moved over to some kind of a theistic position as a result of his thinking through these particular questions. It's quite clear he's not a Christian by any stretch at this point, and unless someone gets a hold of him and shows him some evidence for the God of the Bible and such, he may never become such a one. But it, again, I think, is one more sample of the fact that the way the universe is put together shows very, very strong evidences that we live in a designed universe. Yeah.
Thank you.
Again,
that
evidence
there are a number of other universes besides ours.
There's certainly no scientific evidence that there are more universes than ours. There's a rather interesting biblical remark that suggests that there is another creation than ours, let's put it that way. I think a number of people have already noticed something rather strange about the creation account in Genesis. There's no reference to the angels. And several commentators who have noticed that have put one in. The book of Jubilees, for instance, tells you that the angels are created on day one. Genesis account doesn't say a thing about it. There's a hint in the book of Hebrews, I think, that they weren't created in our creation. And that's the reference to the heavenly tabernacle as not being of this creation, according to the remark of the author there. And if it's not of this creation, you say, well, is it uncreated? Well, I don't know about heavenly tabernacle. Maybe it could be. But the Bible explicitly tells us that angels are created. So my suggestion is that the realm that the angels inhabited is a previous creation of some sort, and we're kind of a creation either within it or next to it or something like that, both created by the same God. So I would say from the Bible we have reason to believe that there are two universes, if you like, although that's going to depend considerably on your definition of universe, okay? Obviously, people with an anthropic principle cast of mind will want to say, yes, there are an infinity of universes, and we have to be in one of a vanishingly small number that's just right for life. And there are no observers in the universes that aren't just right for life. But that is obviously sheer guesswork in that direction, which you would need at least some kind of revelation, I would think, to speak dogmatically. Kuntz.
Carbon being far different.
Obviously, this is something where there will be a disagreement between young Earth creationists, old Earth creationists, and that sort. But on the standard scheme, let's call it a Big Bang type scheme, and I hold to a Big Bang view in which the universe began at the Big Bang. People like Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov believe in a universe which has always existed, and the Big Bang is a bounce every 100 billion years or something. In a Big Bang scheme, after the Big Bang, as this thing cools down, when it finally cools down to reasonable temperatures, you've basically got two or three elements in the universe. You've got a lot of hydrogen, you've got maybe 20% helium, and you've got a percent or so of deuterium and tritium and a couple of the other very light elements. You've got no heavy elements at all. And in their model, this material eventually, at a later point, will coalesce into stars, but there'll be a different kind of star than the star we've got. There'll be a type, I think the astronomers named them type 2 stars, because they didn't know what numerical order to use, though they seem to be earlier stars. And the kind of star we are around is a type 1 star. Type 1 stars have got heavy elements in them. They show up very strongly in the spectrum. Type 2 stars have no heavy elements detectable in the spectrum. It suggests then that the outer layer of these has never been contaminated by heavy elements. Inside these early stars, or type 2 stars, I've got to keep going. So inside these type 2 stars, you will make heavy elements as the star gets older and hotter inside. It will build up the helium nuclei into heavier and heavier and heavier elements. But they're stuck inside unless the star is big enough to be the kind of star that will eventually explode. Then it will blow the stuff all over the area, and it will get the carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and silicon and iron and all of those sort of things out in the neighborhood. And then some of that stuff will collapse into stars again as a contamination of the stars. We can see star formation going on now in our galaxy. And the stuff that is now forming, which is forming in the galactic plane, are type 1 stars, the kind with iron, with the heavy metals in them. And the type 2 stars, which have a different distribution, don't have these heavy metals. So we think, and they look like they're older from calculations we can do, although we can't actually measure their age. So it looks like that really does fit what's going on, that carbon is produced inside stars. And in fact, all the heavier elements. The suggestion on this would be that our star and our Earth would be a second generation of existing things, which would explain then, if cosmologists are right, why the age of the universe is like 10 to 20 billion years, whereas the age of our star and Earth are about 5 billion years. Not in the first generation of stars. Further questions there? That's obviously not beyond question, but that's certainly accepted by cosmologists and therefore could be used to argue against their position if that points for a design universe, which is what we suggest here. And I'm willing to agree with that particular position, but that's the way God did it. Wrong. Yes, Mr. Wells.
Have scientists observed stars
exploding? Oh, yes. The explosion of a star called a supernova. We haven't had any very nearby for about 400 years now. I believe Kepler's time around 1600 was the last time that one exploded near enough to make a very bright star, a star brighter than any star in the sky to us, that is brighter than Sirius and brighter even than the planets Venus and such. But we've observed a number of them further away in our galaxy since we built reasonable telescopes. And every few years you'll see a supernova of some sort. And we can, they're so bright that you can see them in other galaxies. There are a few cases where one star will suddenly brighten for a few months as bright as a whole galaxy is in. So it's up to 100 billion times the brightness of the other stars in the galaxy for a brief time and burns up with fuel in a year or so, what it's got left of it, in the explosion, rather than in some billions of years. One of those occurring moderately nearby would be quite fatal. One of them at a reasonable distance would light up the sky quite substantially. There have been a number of them observed. In fact, there were two or three of them back within a century or so, around 1600, and then there haven't been any since. I think that's just a statistical fluctuation. But further questions?
Do the 800 planets pose a problem for this already?
How?
Well, we get, for instance, the Bible tells us that the moon is there to be a light for night.
Mm-hmm.
But the atheist could argue, we hardly observe any, but on three of them, with God just having commentary, Pluto,
That's an interesting question. Need to analyze what's going on there. One, his raising a question which we do not know the answer does not evaporate the order. Okay, the order is there, whether we know how to explain all sorts of other things. Okay. Now, we can obviously begin to guess why God might have put it there, and the chances that our guesses are right may be very small. One suggestion has been made by evangelicals is that if man had not fallen, he would have already populated a large fraction of the universe. Not because life works very well out there by itself, but because human technology can figure out ways to function in those environments, just as we can send divers down to pressures hundreds of times what we have observed on the surface inside some kind of a diving bell or one of these little alvins or something of that sort, and we can send people up into space and such. So a number of writers have suggested that the universe was made to be populated by man, and he stumbled at the first step, if you like, of his ascent to do all of this. And that's certainly not an unreasonable suggestion. There are other possibilities, that God created other intelligent life and they're out there on some of these other planets, but they're obviously not. The kind of life we know anything about couldn't get along very well on any of these planets in our solar system. And the arguments that I've used here suggest that there aren't many planets in systems around other stars that are likely to work either. But there are just lots of possibilities of why that could have been that way without Christianity being wrong, okay? So all I would say is, you're raising questions to which I don't know the answer, but you haven't evaporated the evidence I've got. That's how it would go there. Yeah.
As soon as you argue, though, that there could be life on another planet, doesn't that kind of hurt the argument here?
No. Because some of them are about a universe that is right to be able to have life, okay? So it doesn't do anything to those. And the remarks about chemistry are also the same kind. That's the chemistry of our universe, okay? The only ones that would do anything to is the environment questions. And what we would say there is either God could have arranged it so he only put life on places where the environment was good, or that he designed certain places to have the environment good, and then the only question you could raise is why did he design others not to have that environment good? And I guess my answer would be life is not God's only purpose for the universe. Let life be everywhere. C.S. Lewis has some interesting remarks in that direction. The universe may have more purposes than man. We've got lots of things there. We don't know the answer to. But I don't think it evaporates the argument. Yeah, further questions? Yes?
You said the Earth was in the second dimension? The second?
No, second generation, I would say. Yeah. Go ahead. Well, we don't know the answer to that. That deals with the question of, does God need to or choose to intervene anywhere in the whole creative process after the first bang? My answer would be yes, that it's very hard to explain life as sort of the stuff just got together. It doesn't appear that chemistry kind of gets together to make life. So it looks like there has to be an intervention there. How many more places there has to be an intervention is hard to judge. judging from the Bible, it sounds like that there either has to be or God chose to have an intervention when he created man. And the question of what the relationship of the kinds to one another are is an unsolved question, but my own inclination is that he intervened in a number of places there too. That once having started life, it doesn't all just kind of run by itself and make all these different kinds. I don't think you've got good evidence for that. It looks like you've got an input of organized information at various places along the line. This book, both of these books by Gordon Rathre Taylor and by Michael Denton point very strongly in that direction, and neither of them are written by theists. They're looking at the evidence of biology and looking at the problems of design and the problems of lack of transitional forms and such. I think point rather strongly in that direction. So, that'd be my inclination. So God may well have intervened in another place. He may have done a few things to make the earth come out right. They'll realize God's got two ways he can work. He can intervene, what we call a miraculous, or he can control things providentially. And we know again and again that he does both of those kind of things. So how much of one and how much of the other in these things, we don't know. Science operates on trying to figure out how to explain things by what we would call providential procedures, that is, by naturalistic things. And to me, a clue that something is not naturalistic is when you begin to hit something that does not look like it's explainable by science. We don't know, for instance, any kind of laws that generate organization, that generate information, etc. Where you hit those kind of things, where you hit some kind of discontinuities, I suspect we're looking at interventions of God. Yes?
This might be a little off the subject, but you said that the Earth, you felt about 5 billion years.
4 billion.
Four billion. Mm-hmm. Now, how did that fit in? How do you understand that?
Genesis account. Here we have what is obviously one of the big controversies in evangelical circles, and that is the question of the age of the earth and the question of the relationship of the Genesis account to the scientific material, the question of whether evolution has occurred or not. In evangelical circles, we have basically three major views, which I would call young earth creationist, old earth creationist, and theistic evolutionist. And the theistic evolutionist is far enough over to the left that many theistic evolutionists are not evangelical Christians, but there are numbers that are. So that's not something I rule out of it as evangelical position. Many of them don't hold an inerrancy, though they're otherwise evangelical, but there are numbers that do hold inerrancy to a theistic evolutionist. Basically, it appears to me they are handling the data problem slightly differently. The young earth creationist is saying, take the biblical material about origins and make the simplest model that fits the data, the biblical data, and then the science has got to conform. The theistic evolutionist is saying, let's look at the scientific information and make the simplest model that fits it, and they're satisfied with some kind of evolution, and then the Bible's got to conform. And so the one will say, well, the Bible doesn't look like it teaches theistic evolution, but that's because this passage is a parable. This passage not to be understood literally. And the younger creationist will say, well, the science doesn't look like it supports an old earth, but that's because of apparent age. It really does. So they're both allegorizing the set of data that they didn't use to make their model. My suggestion is that the Bible pictures two revelations, what we call general revelation and special revelation. And that in any question where both of them are involved, you've got to make a model that fits both sets of data first, not make it with one model, ignoring the other, and then beat on the other until it conforms. Because you can always beat the other into shape, but the chances that you're right are small. It's really quite analogous to what evangelicals do in trying to interpret two parallel passages in Scripture. Take two parallel accounts of an incident in the life of Jesus. The one that I have worked with in one of my exegesis courses frequently, so I use it, is the incident of Jesus casting the demons out of the demoniacs of Gadara. It's pretty clearly the same incident. Jesus and his disciples have just gotten off the boat in all three accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke. There are pig herders on the side of the hill. Demoniac, one in Mark and Luke, two in Matthew, come out, and Jesus talks to the demons, and they ask to be allowed to go into the pigs, and he allows them to go into the pigs, and the pigs run down the hill and get drowned in the water. There are lots of unanswered questions there that I can't answer for you. Whether the pigs were running the show, the demoniacs were running the show, or Jesus was running the show when the pigs ran down the hill into the water, I don't know the answer to all of that. But there are two peculiarities in the thing. One account says this with two demoniacs, and one says it with one demoniac. And one of the accounts uses the name Gerasa, and one of the accounts uses the name Gadara, for where you're located. But as far as I'm satisfied, the other material suggests we're talking about the same incident, so they need to be harmonized. And the way you harmonize it is, seems to me, to say there were two demoniacs, but for some reason, Mark and Luke did not refer to one of them. There are a couple of things you can say about that. One, all of the Gospels are condensed accounts, so the writer doesn't have to write everything. And probably, but here we don't know this, one of the demoniacs was either less demonized or less active in what went on. The other didn't talk. So Matthew records the two demoniacs and the other two to save space to avoid complicating emphasis. Leave out there. Question of Gadara and Gerasa, etc., is a little more complicated. One of the complications is that Gerasa is about 30 miles from the place, and hardly likely to be called the region of Gerasa. I think the explanation of that is that we have gotten the Gerasa 30 miles away confused with a little village called Kursi right near there. That probably the Gerasa is referring to that little town right there at the slope coming down to the lake. And so that's what Matthew is referring to when he uses the term. But that Mark and Luke, in using the term Gadara, figured that their readers, Gentile readers, will have no idea where that town is. So they mentioned the Decapolis town, Gadara, about 8 miles away, which is there. So what I've done is I've tried to make a model that fits both sets of the data without beating on either one of them, or without making the simplest model that fits one and then finding out it doesn't fit the other set of data. That's exactly what I'm recommending here. That the Bible tells us that the heavens declare the glory of God, that the universe really tells us something, let it tell us something. And the Bible certainly really tells us something, let it tell us something. And you're going to run into some places where you have to make a more complicated model than people do who only use one set of data. But your complicated model at least fits both sets of data together. And theirs doesn't. And a person, of course, a person who's not into literature may say, well, we'll just make Genesis 2 a parable. They're going to run into problems eventually with where did the fall come from and lots of things like that. And people without a lot of scientific training sometimes say, well, you know, scientists are changing their mind all the time about things. We can't trust that. But there's really a lot of data out there. And of my understanding of the matter, the young Earth guys are not handling it very well. I've looked at an awful lot of stuff, not looked at everything they've looked at, but I've looked at a lot of stuff they haven't looked at either. A lot of stuff they don't have sort of explanations for. So it's a long discussion, but that's how I would come down with it. I spend 2 or 3 chapters in Genesis 1, the origin of Earth, discussing the scientific evidence and biblical evidence regarding age. And my suggestion would be that the Bible does not tell us when creation took place, that the choice of the 6 days, the 7 days, were out of a much larger number of days. They were extracted out to make a, let's not call it sacrament, that's a little too classy sounding, to make a way in which people would be reminded of creation, that as they observed 6 days a week of work and 1 day of rest, that would remind them of the creation account, and God chose, selected out particular days, significant days out of the creation account to be represented this way, somewhat as God selects the rainbow out of the phenomena surrounding the end of the flood and uses that as a reminder, something the way that Joshua selects 12 stones out of the bed of the Jordan River and sets them up to remind us of something. Something like the way Jesus selects the unleavened bread and one of the wine cups out of the Passover to remind us of something that he's getting ready to do. So that'd be my suggestion, selecting something out of a larger whole as a reminder. Now, I am not have any objection to a relatively young human race. I still would probably not go with 4,000 or 6,000 years, 6,000 years or so. But I am not inclined to go with 1 million or so that many anthropologists are, but I might be wrong. I don't think I am. But that's kind of how it ended. It's sort of a day-age view, but it's got a couple quirks to it. Okay? Yeah, further questions?